2529, Daryl Cannon versus John Birch. Good morning, Mr. Taylor.
Good morning, judges. I'll withhold judgment on that prior case, Your Honor. But this case, judges, presents an extraordinary situation. 29 years ago, this court considered an extraordinary case, a case under the Civil Rights Act under 1983 and 1985, and that case was Bell versus Milwaukee. Now, almost 30 years later, we present to this court a very similar case. In Bell, there was, at the time, and that was back in the late 50s or early 60s, a $3,000 settlement that was entered. Because of a broad-based conspiracy, a racially motivated conspiracy, a conspiracy to conceal and to cover up the true facts of that case, some 20 years later, Dolphus Bell, the father of the deceased victim in that case, was permitted to proceed on a claim of denial of access to the courts. And he was permitted to proceed because this court, at that time, found that that conspiracy to conceal and that concealment and that cover-up, in fact, permitted the family of Dolphus Bell to void that settlement and to proceed. And that settlement of $1,800 in that case went on to become a $1,600,000 verdict some 20 years later. Now, how did the court come to that conclusion in Bell? It looked at the facts of that case and found that the fair and meaningful and effective access to the courts had been denied. And it found that because of that broad-based conspiracy to conceal. It also found that that broad-based conspiracy to conceal prevented the proper functioning of the judicial system and found that that settlement had no binding effect because the plaintiff was unable or failed to present in the first action an account on account of the defendant's fraud or so concealment.
You got some different facts in Bell, though, don't you? Because the abused plaintiff, the tortfeasor, not the tortfeasor, the victim of the abuse, died.
Well, he died.
So he wasn't in a position to advance what he knew, whatever it was that he knew, because he died of his injuries, as I recall. In any event, he died before he could bring his claim. And so later investigations revealed that the culpable facts against the police authority became known and undermined the release that had been entered into by the father or something, the heir of of Bell, who was killed as a result of him. So we don't have that here, do we? We have a victim who knew and was still able to describe and assert whatever his knowledge of the facts was.
Well, in Bell, Your Honor, the decedent, his father, brought the suit. And the public record showed that he knew quite a bit about what had happened in the case.
The father did.
The father did. Both by media accounts, by an inquest, and by the facts that were out there, by the contradictions that were told in the various stories by the police, and particularly the shooter, the fact that the knife that was ultimately shown to have been planted was in fact, and the father knew, the only knife he had was sitting on the dresser in his house at the time. There were several other facts of significance that we outline in our reply brief that show that, in fact, Dolphus Bell knew enough to bring a claim, and in fact, he knew enough not only to bring a claim, but it went to trial. It went to trial, there was a mistrial, and then the settlement took place. So the criteria can't be whether the victim is dead or alive. If Daniel Bell had lived and this same scenario had taken place and Krauss, the partner, had come forward 20 years later, I think we would have had the same result in Bell that we had despite the fact that the man was dead.
Now, you relied on a number of criminal cases to draw a distinction between waiver and forfeiture, but we don't make that distinction in civil cases. There's no forfeiture in civil cases, only waiver. So what we need to know, I think, is where in the record you preserve the issues that the defendants have said that you waived. One, of course, was the creation of false facts argument, and another is your argument that's related to Monell.
Well, Judge, the whole argument in the court below and the voluminous record is all about the issue of Bell. And it's all about the argument that we made here. We may not have crystallized it in exactly the same way, Judge, but we were talking about created facts. We were talking about a cover-up. We were talking about and listing out all the different evidence that supports the fact that there was a cover-up here and that, in fact, Mr. Cannon did not know crucial facts in the same way that Dolphus Bell did not know crucial facts. And those crucial facts was that he just wasn't some man who was in an isolated situation tortured by some vicious officers, but that those officers were part and parcel of a conspiracy, of a pattern and practice that spanned decades, that they were John Burge's right-hand men. They were the men who often implemented the torture practices, and it was a racially based conspiracy. He didn't know that in 16 or 18 of the other cases there was racial abuse. He didn't know that in scores of other cases similar to his case, there was an attack on the genitals. He didn't know that in other cases men were hung by their handcuffs the way they attempted to do with him. He didn't know all of this. He didn't know that these same men under the leadership of Burge had electric shocked tens of other men at this over this pattern of time. So we argued that from the beginning, Your Honor. So I can't see how that we waived or forfeited this argument at all. We were shouting this argument from the top of the steeple, so to speak. And Your Honors, again, in terms of addressing your question about the any differences that might be perceived between Bell and our case, in Bell, it came out 20 years later because the partner came and told the truth and said the knife was planted, and he wasn't a hold-up man. The four or five facts that Mr. Bell didn't know. Well, in Mr. Cannon's case, we have the same result, but it happened differently. And we don't have Dignan or Byrne or any of the defendants coming forward and saying, gee, we really did torture Daryl Cannon, and it was part of a conspiracy to torture these men to get false confessions from them and send them to the penitentiary. But what we do have is a series of very strong after-the-fact admissions by the city of Chicago, by the Chicago Police Department, and by its investigative agency. And let me just mention a few of those. The settlement took place in 1988. In 1992, the city and defendant Martin admitted in the police board proceedings that there was a, quote, astounding pattern and plan by Burge and his men to electric shock suspects. In 1992 as well, after we fought for 2 years to get it released, the Goldston Report was released. And what did the Goldston Report say? The Golston report, which was an OPS report, which was approved by the head of the OPS, it said that there was systematic torture under Burge, that command personnel at Area 2 knew about it and participated in it. And it looked at Mr. Cannon's case among 50 cases. It talked about electric shock, and it put him in that pattern of 50 cases. But then what is even more important, Your Honors, is that because of that, the OPS opened up other investigations, reopened cases. Now, Mr. Cannon's case, originally by the OPS, the disciplinary agency, had been not sustained. It had been not sustained because of the lies that these defendants told to the OPS, and because the OPS, as we all know and come to know, is not the best and most adequate investigative agency.
Excuse me, sir. So one of your claims before this court is that the district court's decision on the enforceability of the settlement and release ought to be set aside.
Or yes.
Reversed.
Yes.
Are you still seeking to affirm the district court on its ruling on the motion to amend to add the RICO claim?
Not to affirm them.
To reverse it, I mean.
Yes, but
the district court relied on the Evans case.
It did, and Judge,
it must have been an important holding.
Well, we.
I say it facetiously, of course, but the district court disallowed the RICO claim, disallowed your motion to amend to add a RICO claim.
That's right.
And I understood from your briefing that you concede that the Evans case forecloses that holding, but you want us to extend or reverse Evans?
That simply,
right?
Without going into any detail, yes, our position is that we would like the court to revisit that issue.
All right. But really the thrust of your argument?
Argument is Bell.
Okay.
Argument is Bell and unconscionability. And going back to kind of finish the thought, if I might, in 1994, that same OPS reinvestigated Mr. Cannon's case. And it found, unlike that earlier cover-up investigation, that Mr. Cannon was tortured by electric shock on his genitals, that he was racially abused, that he was hung by his handcuffs, that he had a shotgun shoved in his mouth 3 times and had the trigger pulled, a mock execution, and that, in fact, his genitalia was attacked. And they found all of these things, Your Honor, and yet, for 4 or 5 years, they suppressed those findings. We fought for those findings for 4 or 5 years before we got them. So those, and then we can proceed onward to other findings and admissions that served the same function as Krauss served when he came forward in the Bell case. And so, Your Honors, we're arguing in that sense that it's no different than Bell. In fact, it's more egregious in a lot of ways than Bell. The conspiracy we have here, only the city could contest it in this brief. The proof, and I ask the court to read our record on this case, is overwhelming. It's an overwhelming record of cover-up and conspiracy. And these defendants that we've sued are at the heart of it. They are at the heart of this conspiracy. We didn't make any mistakes about who we named, Your Honors. And in fact, it turns out that the ones that Mr. Cannon originally named are out there at the heart of it as well. So, Your Honors, you are presented with a situation similar, if not more egregious, than the Bell situation. In Bell, And I want to point the court to the fact that this court has looked at Bell on 2 occasions that we know of. One, and most importantly, is the Vasquez case. And in the Vasquez case, Judge Bauer reevaluated, but he restated the Bell holding. And he said that in Bell, the plaintiff was not permitted a full and open disclosure of the facts crucial to his cause of action.
Did the district court find that this action that was brought by Cannon was timely? Is it within the statute of limitations? And what is the statute of limitations? How do you analyze that?
Okay, that isn't an issue on appeal. But The fact is that the statute was met because Mr. Cannon spent 24 years in the penitentiary on a wrongful conviction based on this false confession, and he got out in 2004 when the state finally dismissed his case after all of this evidence came out, and after the court in 1997, the appellate court, found that res judicata and collateral estoppel didn't apply in his case, and found it was a extraordinary case, special circumstances, and gave him a second motion to suppress. And we went back and we tried that second motion to suppress, and ultimately he was released because of that. So the statute started to run for the present claim for Mr. Cannon in 2004 when he was released. We brought the case in 2005. But that's not really before the court.
I know. I was just seeking clarification.
Thank you.
And I'll reserve my argument on the unconscionability.
I'm going to give you some more time, but you used it all up. And
I did, and I got rolling there. And
come on up, Mr. Huppert. Good. Good morning.
Good morning.
And before you even introduce yourself, I want to start you off because it seems to me that the city has misread Bell. In both Bell and this case, the determinative fact is not what the plaintiffs knew, but what the plaintiffs could not prove because of the cover-up. In each case, the plaintiffs or the plaintiff's surviving representative knew the officers engaged in wrongful conduct, and in each case, the extensive cover-ups prevented them from proving it. What is wrong with my comparison of these cases?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor.
Oh, don't ever say that.
Well, Your Honor, to start with, in Bell, the question was whether the facts of the plaintiff's claim, facts necessary to prove his actual claim, were hidden from him. In that case, it was the successor to the decedent who did not have firsthand personal knowledge of what had happened. And in that case, there was a cover-up to actually conceal the facts of the incident with the police from that successor. Here, Mr. Cannon knew firsthand, had personal knowledge of all of the facts necessary to prove his claim, which separates his claim from Bell. And indeed, in Thompson versus Boggs, this court specifically rejected an argument from a plaintiff who alleged excessive force, who said that the police had covered up the facts of his excessive force claim by omitting it from reports and by denying those allegations, and said, my case is just like Bell's.
Did he have the facts necessary to establish the liability of the city?
I don't believe that Thompson versus Boggs actually addressed Monell liability in that case, Your Honor. But Mr. Cannon actually didn't make any. But Mr. Cannon didn't actually bring a Monell claim in his original case either.
Look, if a defendant destroys evidence of wrongdoing and the plaintiff knows that the defendant destroyed that evidence, does that knowledge preclude the plaintiff from later claiming fraud in the inducement of a settlement? If so, does that mean that the more successfully you lie, you cheat, you commit fraud in litigation, the greater your reward for forcing a small settlement? I cannot see how this is different. I cannot see how this is different.
Well, Your Honor, in Bell, this court actually recognized that Bell was an exceptional case, that it was not simply the defendants getting up and denying liability, which is essentially what happened here. The individual officers denied that they did this.
They didn't just deny. They lied. They cheated. They committed fraud. They committed cover-ups.
And they did it together. They did it as a group.
Well, Your Honor, it certainly Mr. Cannon has not identified a single fact necessary to his claim that he alleges was hidden from him. Mr. Cannon had firsthand personal knowledge of all of the facts necessary to establish his claim, and that's what separates it from Bell, and that's what this court held in Thompson versus Boggs.
Look, you have to help me because I find your argument that, you know, there was no fraud in the first lawsuit. Oh, let me just call it unavailing because I want to be kind. Here are the facts on summary judgment. These officers take a man with a prior murder conviction. Then they lie. Then they torture him into making a statement that leads to a second murder conviction. Then they lie about it. Then they destroy evidence. Then they engage in this incredibly lengthy cover-up with other city officials. You've got to help me. What planet does he have a meaningful redress in the courts under those circumstances? I mean, of course he was forced to settle unfavorably because the officers and perhaps the city have made it virtually impossible for him to prove his case. You would have us enforce a settlement procured by defendants who so rigged the deck that no plaintiff could have proven a legitimate claim. And that, to me, seems to be the bottom line here. And you tell me why it isn't.
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Cannon could have come into court and he could have told his side of the story. And he didn't do that. And as far as allegations from other individuals, Mr. Cannon was aware that those other individuals were making those claims and asked his lawyer to investigate them, and he didn't do that. He could have gone and asked those third parties and brought them in as witnesses to testify to their claims as well, but he didn't do that either.
That astonishes me, that argument, because, in other words, he's supposed to have asked in discovery, by the way, have these officers tortured anyone else? Is the city helping these officers cover up other criminal acts? Was he obliged to ask them if they were committing additional criminal acts? How do you suppose they would have answered?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know how they would have answered.
We are criminals. Of course you know.
But, Your Honor, in order to state a claim for fraud under Illinois law, there must be an affirmative misrepresentation. It's not enough just to have silence. And there was no affirmative misrepresentation regarding those other claims of alleged abuse.
Maybe it's not so much a question of impossibility that Cannon couldn't have brought this as the apparent futility in bringing it. Because even if he had asserted the claim, somebody would have said, oh, yeah, prove it. And he knew he didn't have anybody who was going to corroborate what he said. So even at that point where it's completely futile, you have... because of corruption, basically, you deprived him of access to the courts, haven't you?
Respectfully, I would disagree, Your Honor, because, again, here, Mr. Cannon, it wasn't a claim for futility. Mr. Cannon's claim here is for fraud, not for futility, and Mr. Cannon has to show an affirmative misrepresentation. And as far as the evidence that he could have brought into court, again, if he didn't believe that he was going to get anything from the city, then he could, or from the defendants, then he could have gone and asked the third party who were asserting those claims to come in and testify.
Now, so why is Burge in prison right now? Why? Bottom line, why do you think he's in prison right now? What was it that put him in prison right now?
It was he was convicted of committing perjury for denying acts of torture. Yes.
Exactly.
But certainly. I'm here on behalf of all of the defendants presenting oral argument.
I
represent the city, and the city acknowledges that there were certainly problems at Area 2.
Look, at the time he settled, there was no way for him to even begin to prove his case for torture, much less prove the cover-up. He was, you know, he's in prison for murder based on the confession that he now alleges and indeed alleged from the very beginning was the result of torture. His bargaining position was absolutely non-existent in those circumstances, and it was non-existent because the defendants obtained that conviction through a confession that was given under torture and then covered up the torture, and that, to me, is the bottom line here.
Well, again, Your Honor, but that falls directly into the Thompson versus Boggs case, which holds that where there's personal knowledge, that that's not enough to state a claim for deprivation of the right of access to the courts. And that's what Mr. Cannon had here. No one defrauded Mr. Cannon about the facts of his claim. That's different from Bell, and that is Thompson versus Boggs.
Look,
and that's why
under Bell, the plaintiffs, it seems to me, have shown exactly what they need to show, and any other result would mean that defendants could engage in a decade-long cover-up with impunity. The plaintiffs might know, in quotes, that there's a cover-up in the sense that they know the police are lying, but that's a great distance from being able to prove that that's the case. If we were, it seems to me, you know, I'm one of three, but it seems to me that if the defendants successfully suppress the truth in an effort to force an unfavorable settlement out of a plaintiff, they should not be rewarded for the success of their scheme when the truth eventually comes out.
Well, Your Honor, the holding in Bell was actually that that the plaintiff in Bell, that the defendants there had actually had attempted to convince the plaintiffs that facts about their case were different than what they actually were. In this case, Mr. Cannon has not identified any facts about his case that the defendants tried to convince him were different, because Mr. Cannon knew, unlike the successors in Bell, that what the facts of his case were. And respectfully, that's the difference here between Bell and this case.
Look, the crux of the matter, again, is that no matter what the plaintiffs knew in each of these cases, there were extensive criminal cover-ups that made it virtually impossible for them to prove their cases. And again, it doesn't matter what they knew. It's the defendant's fraud which prevented them from ever proving it. I think it's a miracle that it was ever proved. A miracle. I'm sorry, Mr. Hufford, but it's where I am.
Well,
could you take a minute now and tell me and represent just the city?
Yes, Your Honor.
And tell me your best case for why the city is not liable.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if we have a case like this, but the fact of the matter was that in the original suit, Mr. Cannon made the city a party to the settlement without having brought any claim against the city, no Monell claim, without having investigated it, without having developed it, and chose to settle all of his claims against the city without having developed any suit or any claim against the city.
As I understand Mr. Cannon's claim, he says now we have a different situation. I did not know at the time of the settlement, nor could I know because of a cover-up, the extent of the police force's involvement in this kind of practice and the city's toleration of this practice.
Okay. Well, Your Honor,
tell me what's your answer to that?
The record in this case actually demonstrates that Mr. Cannon was aware of others making claims, in fact, against these same defendant officers, and in fact informed his attorney that he knew that others were making these claims, and that it was important at that time to do an investigation of those claims for his lawsuit, and failed to undertake any investigation at that time. So to the extent that Mr. Cannon is claiming that anyone deprived him of knowledge, Mr. Cannon never asked anyone, and so therefore no one ever made any misrepresentations to Mr. Cannon about those other claims of abuse at Area 2.
Does it make any difference that it would have been futile for him to do so?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't make a difference because this we're dealing with a settlement agreement, an attempt to escape that settlement agreement by fraud. And fraud under Illinois law requires an affirmative misrepresentation. So regardless of a claim for futility, the fact of the matter is there was no affirmative misrepresentation, which is a requirement for a fraud claim under Illinois law.
So if we set aside this waiver, or find it to be an unenforceable agreement because of the unconscionability of it, what do you foresee happens then? What's next?
Well, Your Honor, if the agreement were set aside, then there would need to be a remand to the district court to proceed with the merits of the claims.
And then the plaintiffs would bring the action that you said they didn't bring.
Well, they brought a Monell claim in this litigation, Your Honor.
Okay.
It was the original litigation where there was no
Monell. So now
Monell
it goes
claim.
Back and everybody's before the court, and there's either a trial or another settlement. Is that right?
That's correct. Well, Your Honor, you had asked about the statute of limitations issue earlier, and we actually did brief the statute of limitations issue on the fraud claim in the district court, and the district court chose not to address that claim at the time because it granted summary judgment on the release. So to the extent that that issue is still pending, we've asked in our brief that the district court be instructed to consider that statute of limitations argument, because there is a five-year statute of limitations for a claim for fraud in Illinois. And Mr. Cannon, as we heard from his counsel, through the years before he brought any claim to attempt to escape from this settlement agreement, there were facts that came to light in that interim, and for that reason we did raise the statute of limitations on the fraud claim below.
Don't you think this is given all the things you know now, and all the corruption that's come to light, and the facts that have settled out in a different way than anybody understood or would admit at the time the settlement agreement was entered into, don't you think that it's a thin reed on which you're attempting to hang your resolution to say, given all of that, $3,000 is a fair settlement. Don't you think that's sort of a thin reed?
Well, Your Honor, first we have to look at what Mr. Cannon's demand was at the time, and that was for $45,000. And in addition to that, Mr. Cannon chose to settle not only whatever claims he had in the original complaint, but all claims that may arise in the future or arising directly or indirectly out of those prior allegations, and accepted $3,000. And there were other issues that weighed into that decision, most likely, including the fact that Mr. Cannon has admitted essentially the facts of his own involvement in the underlying crime here, which he claims he was wrongfully convicted of, which plays into his ability to recover for that conviction.
He admitted to it because of torture.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, in his deposition, he admitted to having gone with the trigger man, A.D. McChristian, to pick up the victim, to having driven the car while they had a discussion in the background, to be driving the car when the gun went off, to not having turned around when the gun went off, and still knowing that Darren Ross was dead, to driving the car out to help dispose of the body under no duress or coercion, to having disposed of the body without objecting to what was going on at the time, to having disposed of the body without having considered getting medical attention for Mr. Ross. And he admitted all of those facts in his deposition in this case. There was no torture in this case. Those are the actual facts as he's admitted them on the record in this case. And for
you mean there's a chance he might settle for $3,000 again?
I don't know that we would
rhetorical,
get it.
Rhetorical.
Right.
You don't have to.
You know, you didn't respond to Gannon's argument relying on a First Circuit case that excessive force and the cover-up of excessive force are separate and distinct claims. That's that argument at the bottom of page 42 and page 43 of the opening brief. Do you want to take a quick look at it? If you can. And maybe you would want to respond. If not,
well, Your Honor, even if this court were to follow that decision in Landrigan, the fact of the matter is that the release language that Mr. Cannon signed in this case was broader than just his claim for the excessive force. His release that he signed and that he executed with the advice of counsel actually incorporated all future claims that he may have and all claims that arose directly or indirectly from his allegations of excessive force. And for that reason, it really doesn't matter whether or not those are two separate claims, because Mr. Cannon chose to settle all of and release all of his claims related to that underlying allegation of excessive force at the time. And I see I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Is there anything you want to add?
No, I'm happy to answer any further questions, Your Honor, but we would ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Taylor, you know you used up your time, but we'll give you
if you have any questions,
3 more minutes.
Honors,
we'll give you 3 minutes if you wish it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. I don't mind being interrupted at all.
Mr. Taylor, I would appreciate your reply to the question I asked your brother, and that is with respect to the city. He indicated that the city has had to engage in an affirmative act of fraud in order to still have some continuing liability after the settlement agreement. Is that correct? And if so, where's the city's affirmative act of fraud?
The city is all of these defendants, Your Honors.
No, the city is a municipality that's one of the defendants here.
Right.
And it has a specific type of liability under the Monell Doctrine.
That's right.
And what I want to know is why does their Monell liability, why do they still have Monell liability after that settlement? What is the continuing act of fraud that the city engaged in that still makes it liable after that settlement agreement?
Okay, there's policymakers, Your Honor, and that's only how the city acts, and that's where the Monell comes from. Starting with Superintendent Brzezak, who suppressed for 20 years the fact that he knew that Andrew Wilson was tortured and that his high-level people knew as well that electric shock was going on. In fact, the special prosecutor found, Your Honors, that this court was deceived in the Wilson case by the superintendent of police in 1993 when they came before it and Brzezak was excused from that particular case. So Brzezak, number one. Leroy Martin, who was the commander at Area 2 and later went on to be the police superintendent. He was involved in covering up the Goldston report, Your Honor, in suppressing for several years and then trying to discredit those findings by his own police agency that there was systematic torture. Hillard, superintendent of police, he was the one who, when Cannon and the police investigative agency reinvestigated his case and then found that he'd been tortured in all those various sadistic ways, Hillard came in as superintendent, and he tried to overturn and did overturn those findings. There's three superintendents of police. I won't even go into the mayor, Your Honors, because we don't have time right now to go into all of what the city, through its policymakers, its high-level people, did and continued to do. For the city to turn its back on this scandal and say, well, John Burge is in jail, okay, well, that's not us. Well, it is them, Your Honors, and Judge Lefkoe found that to be the case when she sentenced John Burge and she chastised the city administration and the state's attorney's office and talked about how it was a tremendous failure of leadership within the city. So that's my answer.
I think I have the point. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Case is taken under advisement. Thanks to all parties.